This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The world is awash in ways we can make a difference, but often we are our own worst enemies. We downplay our ideas as silly or impractical, or if we do present them to others, they get shot down and we never bring them up again. Nilla from Merchant wants to change that.
Merchant is an entrepreneur and innovative business thinker who's launched more than 100 products and successfully advised companies like Apple. Her new book is called The Power of Onlyness. It's a series of stories and examples of how people turned not me into yes, let's go, and in the process made a difference in the world. Merchant was in Milwaukee last week, and she stopped by the studio to explain what she means by onlyness.
I coined the term back in 2011, 2012, and it was a business concept that I was trying to name. I was trying to say value creation shifted from organizations and from capitalization to ideas. Where do ideas come from? They come from that spot only you stand. And so I was characterizing that, but like struggling with, well, how do you name it? And in a distributed world, it would mean that ideas born of different onlys could actually count. And yet I was trying to use words like talent, and talent didn't work, and then words like uniqueness. And I'll tell you why talent didn't work, because it might help. Talent is often when people say someone's talented, they'll often say, oh, it's because someone has credentials or someone has the right academic background or the right brands that they've worked with. And I was trying to say, no, what is that thing that says each and every single one of us has some bit of value to add to the world? Based on that spot in the world, only they stand. And we kept kind of coming back to that notion of only, and hence this distributedness, right? Connectedness allows you to scale things. So that's the heritage of the word onlyness.
And it is individual, as you say, but you've also expanded it into the idea of it being collaborative, too, that there are many onlys that can come together to become greater than the sum of its parts.
Right. I wasn't saying only like more of you. Because onlyness could be like that kind of word, right? Could be a hybrid word, which like cats, like the S added to cat is more of cats, you know, kind of thing, the plural. I was trying to say, what is it that you care about based on that spot in the world only you stand in, based on your history and experience, visions and hopes, that then connects you to the world? And so that's the braidedness of the two pieces. Those two belong together.
And you have a lot of examples in the book of how people had this spark of an idea, maybe not even a whole idea yet, but some niggling thing that says, this isn't right and I want to fix it, or I see something that could do something else, but then how they expand that. And how do you see this as different from, say, any other business manual that says, you know, everyone collaborates and works together and, you know, makes a product? How is this different?
Well, I think there's probably three pieces to that. One is there's a lot of us whose only don't count. We get told, because we don't fit the cultural dominant narrative, we get told that our ideas are marginal and therefore meaningless. Just as an example of that, and I'll click back to those other two pieces. So an example of that was Kimberly Bryant, who wanted to shape the future of technology. She wanted people who look like her to really be an equal member of the tech community. When she was first introduced to her colleagues at first sort of major engineering job she had, her boss introduced her not by Kimberly Bryant and here, the passion she has, or Kimberly Bryant and the unique skills she brings, but Kimberly Bryant, with her, we got a twofer. And what her boss was pointing out was that Kimberly is a Black woman in tech. And so he was basically characterizing her otherness, not her onlyness, right? That thing that would allow her to contribute that which only she could bring and actually allow her to build on our ideas. So for those of us whose only have been marginalized, the first step in this process is to claim your only even when someone else has deemed it not valuable.
Which can be so difficult to do.
Oh my gosh. It's the most, you know, sometimes when I'm talking to people, they make it like they look back at me like, gosh, that seems pretty normal. And I said, yeah, it's both the most ordinary idea in the world and the most revolutionary idea in the world at the same time, depending on who you are. Right. And it just the difference is that There's 30 to 40% of a population that fit the dominant cultural narrative that is told in America that is mostly white, heterosexual males. So for the rest of us, we get to leave our ideas mostly at the door because we're told messages, right, that we have to overcome in order for us to be able to claim our ideas. The statistic that really struck me, though, to show how big of a problem this is, though. So one of the pieces of research I found was that 61%, and this is a U.S. statistic, of the U.S. population conforms or fits in to the dominant narrative. So they basically, the word that the researcher used was, do you cover? So this was self-recognized covering. And the examples were like the guy who didn't want to talk about his kids at work because he was afraid his colleagues would think he didn't care and wasn't committed to his job. And so he found himself covering his own passions and interests about being a good dad and having an equal responsibility as a family man and sort of focused on other things. And there were tons of other examples. And the 61% number didn't shock me, but I'll tell you what did. A whopping 45% of single white men cover. And what that shows us is how significant this covering thing is. And the implication is when we're not showing up fully alive in the places we work, in our communities, even in our own lives, what it means is we're not showing up with our ideas. And that little bit, or maybe big bit, that we could add to the world because we're figuring out a way just to hide, right? And how to fit in. And fitting in is the greatest cost to our own ideas.
But yet, one of the things that was a sort of a theme through the examples that you wrote about in the book is that innovation, coming up with or allowing these new ideas to blossom, oftentimes it gets stifled because I think as a species, we tend to want to go to the familiar. We are creatures of habit. Even when it's not a good habit, we tend not to want to break away from it. So the innovation sort of withers on the vine. And so how does onlyness and embracing that help us get past that hurdle?
Well, it goes back to the three things I was going to say, and then I distracted myself by telling a story. But you've just helped me kind of clue back in. So the first piece is to claim, which we just kind of talked about with Kim, really choosing to claim that part of the story that was hers. And by the way, Kim's gone on to train 10,000 black girls to code by starting a program. And she named it Black Girls Code, partly to claim back that story that was hers and to say, no, even if other people in society say this is not important or marginal in some way, for her it was meaningful. The second piece is to figure out, how do you find the other people like you? And whatever that little sliver of interest is, now you can, but it means you have to know how to signal your own interests and to seek the other people out, and then how to even have a common framework, how to have those other people you can count on. So that piece of finding, you know, it's so overused and yet such a deep insight about how do you find your people, not just based on heritage or socioeconomic education or all those other things, but based on what you're passionate about.
And I think everyone would say, well, I don't know. You know, sometimes you just fall into them. You're lucky, you meet. But this sounds way more intentional than that. This is actively seeking those people.
It is. And I was fascinated by the story of Alex Hillman when I found it, because Alex was a young man in, where was he, Philadelphia, and was working at a web design firm during the day. And as he described it to me, sort of sitting over his computer hunched over at eating Chinese takeout every night because he was so deeply lonely and he missed having a group of people who he called, you know, creative maker types. And everywhere he would go in Philadelphia, he would say, gosh, I can't seem to spot anyone like me. And they seem sort of older and more traditional, and even the tech community seems sort of dated. And so he was going to leave. And at one point, the job he was going to leave to in Silicon Valley ends up falling apart. And he kind of thinks, I love Philadelphia, though. I love the spirit of it. I might just try one more time to find my people. And this was really a fun little part of the vignette. He says, and I changed what I wore to the next event. And he changed from wearing suits to these events to wearing these ironic T-shirts that he loved and flannel sort of sweatshirts over it. And then he basically looked for someone who was as geeky as him. And his only goal at that one event was to find one person. Then he went out and asked that person out to beer. Then the next event, he tried to find the next person. And after a while, he started gathering those people together. So it was super intentional. And digitally, he was actually searching them out, like on LinkedIn, and figuring out, like, did they match the profile of, you know, what he was looking for, until he finally started gathering all these people together in coffee shops every Friday, these geeky developers. And finally, first of all, he didn't feel alone. But it turns out that this thing that he thought he was the only one, he ended up finding a whole tribe of them. And they ended up building a co-working space together that's called Indie Hall in Philadelphia. 300 people now co-work together in this space. And when I talked to the deputy mayor of Philadelphia and I said, you know, what did this mean for you? And he said, you know, we always wanted to be an entrepreneurial hub, but we could never find those people. And what Alex and then his crew of people did was basically self-organize. And now all of a sudden the city could figure out how to serve these entrepreneurs better. And so there's this weird thing about when you find your people, you think they're invisible, but it's you signaling what you care about. And that's why the shirt changing thing was so interesting, right? Like, because he's almost rolling up his sleeves and showing his tats in that process. And then signaling, like, here's who I am, world. Who are you back? And then intentionally finding the people who had similar passions and therefore could ultimately end up doing something with that.
You talk a lot about people discovering that they're asking the wrong question and being willing to say, whoa, I thought it was about this, but it's really about this. And being able to then take steps. And it sounds like if you have your tribe together, that if you discover you've asked the wrong question or series of questions, it's more easy to shift. Because institutions aren't known for being able to shift quickly.
That's true. And this has actually been the work I've been doing for the last 20-some years, right, is I've been figuring out how to do organizational transformation. And so what's funny now in looking at this set of stories, because now I'm focusing on the individual ideas out and less organization down, I'm sitting here going, okay, what is it that derives real change from the organic level out? And this thing that you're pointing out, which is about how you change the framework by which we hold something as true, is a way in which you can actually create change. Franklin Leonard was my favorite story out of the book. In that example, Franklin is a young man who ends up showing up in Hollywood basically as a grunt after working at McKinsey and a couple other places, and mostly just because he loved movies. And he's like, oh, I'm going to join this industry and I'll figure it out. And the first year is brutal because he can't find any scripts he likes, and yet that's one of his jobs, is to find scripts. So he sends out a note to everyone he's met, and he asks them three questions. And he says, tell me a script that you love that hasn't been put into production that you've seen in the last year. And he says, in return, I will cross-tabulate all this stuff, because he's a former McKinsey guy, cross-tabulate all this stuff and produce it back to you. That's my give. Do this by Friday and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And he ends up creating an alias so people don't even know it's him. And he gets all this stuff back, prints out the five scripts he's most interested in, goes on vacation. 2 weeks later, this was the days when we could actually escape our digital life. And he comes back and his email is full of people forwarding him this master list that he had created, saying, this is so cool. And he's telling me the story. And I said, well, you know, Franklin, what did you think you did different? Like, what do you think really caused it to succeed? And he said, oh, I did this and did that. And I don't really think that's it. And this is me kind of giving him feedback, right? And the more I looked at stories that were parallel to him, because I studied 300 stories in order to pick the final 20 that made it in the book, and I thought it was actually quite different. It was that he asked an original question. So he asked, and he asked it so fast even that I think you can skip past it. He asked, what movie do you love? What script do you love? And if you think about how Hollywood was actually sorting at the time, they were sorting by how did this make money?
I think they still do, probably.
But... Well, and so it turns out the Blacklist has deeply informed how Hollywood sorts scripts. So that's the organization that he's built. And in fact, I think it was something like 300 of the top films that were produced in terms of just revenue, something like 75% of them were first on the Blacklist. So these are films that were in the dustbin that are basically resurrected by people who say, no, 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 this is an idea worth paying attention to. But what was so fascinating was this tilt of frame. Going back to the original question of any industry, right? Healthcare, for example, is an industry that's premised on care, but doesn't always achieve that. Education, driven by learning, doesn't always achieve that. So how do you originally go back to the original question of, what are we here to do? And how do you reframe that question together in such a way that you can start to create change? And I would say every person did that by having a new lens and by holding on to that lens both tightly enough and loosely enough that they were able to create the change. Tightly enough meaning they never lost their original vision, but loosely enough so that a whole bunch of people could hold that idea as their own. So, in fact, as you and I are here, I'm opening my hand and closing my hand to show this visual. So, if we hold an idea so tightly that no one else can pick it up from our fist, it can never become theirs. It's only yours to own. And so I often think about how do you hold an idea in such a way that you're almost proposing it to the world, like, world, come and pick it up with me. And so you're definitely putting it out there, but you're trying to create a space for it in such a way that other people can also come build it into something much bigger.
Well, that kind of takes me to my last question. We could keep talking for days about this, and it's fantastic. But you used a particular word, and it's actually right in the subtitle of your book, about making a dent.
Hmm.
What is it about dent as opposed to taking over the entire world? Why is a dent important?
It's so funny you asked that question because so many people didn't like it when people would hear me describe the subtitle, make your wild ideas mighty enough to dent the world. Like, oh, I don't like the word dent.
Sounds like a mistake.
It does, mm-hmm. Right? But I think about it as almost reshaping the world. You don't reshape the world in this big thing. You kind of like almost little by little. And so the picture that comes to mind is like a copper molder kind of shaping a pot of little by little shaping the world into what it needs to be. I feel like sometimes we go for these big things. And in fact, you know, the 20 stories I did choose really accomplished tectonically wonderful things, and yet they're relatively unknown players. If I could characterize them this way, ordinary people doing extraordinary things, not because they thought it was such a big idea at the beginning, but because they gave themselves permission to change the littlest thing that they saw. And I feel like that's the way we're going to actually create change from now on, is not by saying, oh, gargantuan, tectonic thing. It's like, what do you see that needs fixing? Go fix that. And this is how we'll imprint ourselves into the world, even if it's small. That's good.
So don't be afraid to make mistakes, and don't be afraid to make a dent.
And to start.
Nilufer Merchant, it has been such a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Author Nilufer Merchant is a leading business thinker and innovator. Her latest book is The Power of Onlyness: Make Your Wild Ideas Mighty Enough to Dent the World. She was in Milwaukee last week to speak at a 1-800-CEO-READ event and stopped by the studio then.